For those who don't know me, my name is Kimberly, and it is my privilege to be sharing with you this morning. I'm actually a little bit emotional, so we'll get through this together. The Growing Young series is based around a book by Cara Powell, Jake Mulder, and Brad Griffin. And in it, they discuss six essential strategies to help young people discover and love your church. Just a reminder, if you have borrowed a copy of this from the church office and you're finished with it, can you please return it? And if you haven't read it yet and you still want to, let the church office know and they can give you a copy to read. There's also one on CD for people who aren't into reading. So to begin with, I'd like you to turn to your neighbour and to tell them four words or phrases you'd use to describe our church. Off you go. Okay, would anyone like to call their words out? What have you got for me? Hope? Sorry, serving? Yeah. Godly? Welcoming? Giving? Friendly. Okay, so when people that were part of the Growing Young study were interviewed about their churches, researchers noticed that the same words kept coming up. Welcoming, accepting, belonging, authentic, hospitable, and caring. In fact, these words came up so often that when the researchers started calling them warmth clusters, but it's the phrase that was heard most often that I would like to focus on this morning. So what was this phrase? Like a family. If you're like me, you hear that and you say, well, yeah, that's what people say when they're around other people regularly that they feel a connection with. You know, how's your new job going? Oh, it's great, they're just like a family. We've all heard this before. But the more that I thought about it, the more I realised that the idea of church working best when it's like a family shouldn't surprise us at all, because the New Testament describes this regularly. Paul begins his letters, "Grace and peace to you from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ." And brothers and sisters is his favourite way to describe the people he visits on his travels in Acts and Romans. Romans 8, 15 to 16. This resurrection life you received from God is not a timid grave-tending life. It's adventurously expectant, greeting God with a childlike, "What's next, Papa?" God's Spirit touches our spirits and confirms who we really are. We know who He is, and we know who we are, Father and children. And we know we're going to get what's coming to us, an unbelievable inheritance. Ephesians 1, 4 to 5. Long, long ago, he decided to adopt us into his family through Jesus Christ. What pleasure he took in planning this. He wanted us to enter into the celebration of his lavish gift-giving by the hand of his beloved Son. But the one that's been on my mind a lot over the past few months is John 19, 26 to 27. When Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to her, "Woman, here is your son," and to the disciple, "Here is your mother." And from that time on, the disciple took her into his home. This conversation takes place when Jesus is on the cross, literally mid-crucifixion. We can assume that he's exhausted mentally, physically, and emotionally, as well as in a lot of pain and struggling to breathe. So anything that Jesus says here is really important, because speech is not something that would come easily at this point. "Here is your son, here is your mother." Why did he say that? It was a patriarchal society. Men were the ones that had the power. There was no welfare system. And so Mary needed a male guardian, if you will, someone to look after her. But she had other children, other sons even. The Bible tells us that their names were James, Joseph, Simon and Jude. So why did Jesus make a point of pairing her up with his favourite disciple? We also need to remember that at this point, Jesus' siblings did not believe he was the Son of God, so they possibly weren't there witnessing his final hours. You could argue that Jesus was just worried about his mum and who was going to take care of her for him. But Jewish tradition was that the oldest surviving son would always take responsibility for his mother. So from a Jewish perspective, it was obvious that Jesus' next oldest brother would be caring for Mary once he had died. Theologian Tom Wright also points out that men who were known to be Jesus' disciples were probably in hiding at this time, as it wasn't safe for them to be around. So this favourite disciple was likely still quite young, since he was able to be there without being seen as a threat to those carrying out the crucifixion. The more that I think about it, the more I wonder if Jesus was trying to make a point. His new church that was about to be established would only reach its true potential once his followers began to view each other as family, mother and father, brother and sister, and to treat one another accordingly. So why a family? Couldn't we just be friends, workmates, or neighbours? I believe that there are a few reasons for this. As Growing Young tells us, family isn't neat, it's messy. Young people desire not only to share their messiness, but to also walk alongside the authentic messiness of others. When we see church as something other than family, messiness becomes something we can pretend doesn't exist, rather than something that we face together and support one another through. Biologists tell us that the survival of a species depends on cooperation rather than competition. Those who survive, and especially those who flourish, do so as participating members of families, clans, and tribes. In other words, you alone can do it, but you cannot do it alone. Family gives us the support we need to be our best selves. As Lawrence Kushner says in his Book of Words, home is where they have to let you in simply because you're you, and family are the people who live there. They are the ones you get whether you like them or not, and in the last tally, they may be all any of us have. The power of congregational life comes from precisely this involuntariness of association. We look about the room and realise these people are not friends or even acquaintances. We do not agree with them about much. These are simply people we are stuck with. And this generates a kind of love, both more intense and more complicated than the voluntary variety. These members of our community, just like the people in our family, literally make us who we are. I think that another reason we need to be family is because it is through family that information is passed on, skills are taught, and God's faithfulness is shown. It is through family that we learn who we are, where we have come from, and to a degree, what our future may look like. In fact, the Bible has a lot to say about this. Psalm 78, 2-4. Listen, dear friends, to God's truth. Bend your ears to what I tell you. I'm chewing on the morsel of a proverb. I'll let you in on the sweet old truths, stories we heard from our fathers, counsel we learned at our mother's knee. We're not keeping this to ourselves. We're passing it along to the next generation. God's fame and fortune, the marvellous things he has done. Psalm 89, verse 1. I will sing of the steadfast love of the Lord forever. With my mouth I will make known his faithfulness to all generations. Joshua 4, 6 and 7. When your children ask you, what are these stones to you? You'll say, the flow of the Jordan was stopped in front of the chest of the covenant of God as it crossed the Jordan, stopped in its tracks. These stones are a permanent memorial for the people of Israel. Hebrews 11 gives us a long list of people from the Old Testament. Abraham, Sarah, Noah, Isaac, Jacob, Abel, Moses, Enoch, sharing stories of their faith and reminding us of God's faithfulness to them, encouraging us that God will be faithful to us too. Deuteronomy 6, 4-9. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them to your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. Note that this verse is directed at the entire nation of Israel, not just the parents. As members of God's family, we are commanded to tell those in different generations our stories of God's love, his grace, his goodness, and his faithfulness. But not just the happy stories that end up tied in a nice big bow, but also the ones that say, well, that didn't end the way I hoped it would. Or the ones that go, I'm really confused and upset with what's happening right now. Is God with me in this? Can I trust him? Matthew 5:15 says, neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand and it gives light to everyone in the house. The way that I see it, sharing our lives and stories with those in your own generation is like putting the lamp on the table. But if we share our lives and our stories intergenerationally with those older and younger than us, we become a lighthouse. Still a lamp, but way more powerful, showing the way to those coming after us. If we are to be passionate about having a church family that is growing young and a church that raises world-changing Christians, we need to share these types of stories with each other. Older generations must become lighthouses by sharing stories of God's faithfulness in their lives with those in younger generations. But this is not only up to the older people. Younger people have a role to play too. In Acts 2, Peter quotes the prophet Joel, "In the last days, God says, I will pour out my spirit on every kind of people. Your sons will prophesy and also your daughters. Your young men will see visions. Your old men dream dreams. When the time comes, I'll pour out my spirit on those who serve me, men and women both, and they'll prophesy." I recently listened to a sermon by Wendy Holland in which she says that here last days does not refer to end times, but to after the Messiah or Jesus has come. And prophecy doesn't mean telling the future, but preaching the word of God, being a designated spokesperson for the Lord. One of the problems with our culture is that we can romanticise falling in love and getting married and having a baby, and we can forget, or if you're yet to do some of these things, not realise that becoming a family can be hard. All of a sudden, you've got someone else to think of, and routines and behaviour patterns you barely realised you had can suddenly become contentious. The close proximity of marriage and family can also shine a light for us on areas of our own life that we need to improve on. Mike and I had quite a bit of trouble falling pregnant, and so by the time Rory, our firstborn, came along, we'd been married for almost 8 years. And after 8 years, our marriage had a comfortable rhythm and routine, and then this baby came along, and all those balls we'd been so efficiently juggling between us just got thrown into the air. We fought more that first year of Rory's life than we had in the entire 8 years beforehand. There was a massive readjustment for us as we got used to having a new but deeply wanted little person in our family. In her book, Welcoming Children, Joyce Mercer reminds us that children and childhood are gifts from God, not because they're carefree, but because God has a purpose for children. God gives children to the church and the world so that God may be known. She then quotes Mark 9:37, "When you welcome a child, you welcome me. And when you welcome me, you welcome not only me, but also the one who sent me." So what is it that families do, and how can we do more of these things here at Whangarei Central Baptist? Firstly, families mix and talk intergenerationally. Within my family, I interact with four different generations: my grandparents, my parents, my aunts and uncles, and my in-laws, my husband, my siblings, my cousins, and my brother and sister-in-laws, and finally my children, my nieces, and my nephews. If you are attending church or going to home group, and the only people that you are talking to or interacting with are people who share your generation or life stage, that's teenagers with other teenagers, parents of small children with other parents of small children, empty nesters with other empty nesters, or retirees with other retirees, then we are not being a family. Secondly, family members know each other's names and how to pronounce them correctly. I know that realistically, most of us are not going to know everybody's name in this room. Knowing someone's name is important, and pronouncing it correctly is even more so. In her article, My Name is My Story, Mylin Marie Stormin Tring says, "If a person can't say my name correctly after being corrected more than 3 times, I'm not going to bother forming any sort of real relationship with them. I can't help it. I take it as an affront when people don't learn how to say the most important words in my life the correct way." If we want to welcome people of all ages into our church family and do it in such a way that they truly feel a sense of belonging, we need to not only learn their names, but learn to pronounce them correctly. So try setting yourself a challenge. Each Sunday, I will learn the name of somebody new. Or even better, each Sunday, I will learn the name of somebody who is at least 20 years older or younger than me. Thirdly, families learn and remember new things about each other. The church that I went to while I was at university has a big young adults ministry. And the first time I went to one of their events, I had quite a few people come up and talk to me. They asked me, where are you from? What are you studying? Which hostel are you staying in? Just typical first year uni small talk. And I thought, hey, this is great. The people here are really friendly. When I went back the next week, the same people came up and talked to me. And they asked me the same questions as they had the week before. Unfortunately, this happened the following week as well. We have to do better than this. So, when you meet someone new, make a real effort to remember something from your conversation. And the next time you see them, ask them about it. How's your veggie garden coming along? Did you finish your book? What are you going to read next? Another thing that families do is eat together. In his article, Eating, Family and Faith, Simon Carey-Holt says, a family is that group of scattered individuals who come together at the end of the day, most commonly around the meal table. They may or may not be related by blood, but every time they meet there, they acknowledge their identity as a family and reaffirm their sense of belonging. There is a sense in which our meal table defines the boundaries of our community. Occasionally, or regularly, an outsider is invited to the table, and in welcoming them, we communicate that, for the period of the meal at least, this person is no longer a stranger. They belong with us. So how do we make this happen here at Central Baptist? Stay after church for our shared lunches, and if you're feeling really brave, sit with people you don't know so well. Invite someone who is different than you over for a meal, or sign up at the information table for Hospitality Sunday, when once a month, people from our church host others for lunch. Finally, families share their lives and stories with each other. In Psalm 119:89-90, we read, your word, Lord, is eternal. It stands firm in the heavens. Your faithfulness continues through all generations. How does the psalmist know that God's faithfulness continues through all generations? They've seen it. They've heard the stories of how God was faithful to their parents, their grandparents, their great-grandparents. They've experienced God's faithfulness for themselves, and now they're seeing God being faithful to their children, maybe even their grandchildren or great-grandchildren. And in those times that they've doubted God's faithfulness, they've clung to glimpses of it in the lives of others around them. Because ultimately, this isn't about God being faithful to my family or to your family, but to his church as a whole. And unless we share these stories among us, generation to generation, we're not going to see it. Some of you will know that before I was born, my parents were missionaries in India with an agency called InterServe. When they came back to Whangarei, they began attending monthly InterServe meetings, a shared lunch followed by a time of prayer for those still serving overseas. My brother, sister, and I were always the only children at these meetings, and generally speaking, the people next closest in age to us were probably our parents. But through these, we would have lunch with everyone and then play quietly while the adults talked and prayed. But through these lunches, we developed relationships with the other people there. We would listen as they talked about their kids and their grandkids, and they would talk to us about things like school, our sports games, the books we were reading, and what we'd done in the holidays. One of these people was my great uncle, Fred Jenkins. He was an incredibly generous man. One time we went away on holiday, and when we came home, we found that Uncle Fred had filled our garage with firewood for the winter. And when my grandpop died, Uncle Fred showed up at Grandma's with a car full of food. He'd bought every rotisserie chicken in the supermarket. Another person we got to know was Val Taylor. Val had caught polio as a child and lost the use of her legs as a result. Val loved going to the movies, but once she was in a wheelchair, she could no longer go as she couldn't get up the stairs and into the theatre. Then a new cinema was built in town, and this one had a lift, especially for those in wheelchairs. And after that, Val went to the movies every week. The last person I'd like to tell you about is Ruth Edwards. My mum used to tell me, Mrs. Edwards has prayed for you since the day you were born. Ruth's parting words to me just before I went to university were that God does not let any experience go to waste. Now that I'm an adult with children of my own, I reflect back on those undeserved meetings and I am blown away by the generosity of those who attended, the way that they opened their homes and their lives to us. When my parents decided to attend their meetings and to bring three small children along too, the group could easily have said, oh, this isn't the sort of thing you can bring kids to, and turn them away. But instead, they pulled up extra chairs and welcomed us into their group. And through sharing their lives with us for a couple of hours each month, they gave us glimpses of a life of faith that have stayed with us long after they're gone. A few months back, I was talking to my dad about this sermon, Growing Young and Intergenerational Church. And Dad shared a memory with me he has from about 50 years ago when he was a teenager here in the church. He remembers his Auntie Edna saying, I don't understand. Why are we staying in here, the youth going out the back and the kids out there? It's not going to be like that in heaven. This process of us becoming a church who are like a family will not always be easy. You may even say, as I did, mere moments before my son Hamish was born, I've changed my mind, I don't want to do this anymore, take me home. Is this going to be easy? Not always, but is it going to be worth it? Absolutely. If we truly want to be a church that grows young, a church that unlocks keychain leadership, empathises with today's young people, takes Jesus' message seriously and fuels a warm community, we must become more like a family, making a deliberate point of doing life together and sharing our stories across generations. This can't be something that is optional or left up to other people. It is an intentional, deliberate lifestyle for us all. Building intergenerational relationship needs to be a key part of what it means to be a member of the Whangarei Central Baptist family, where we recognise that in Christ we are all family, not because we chose each other, but because we have been chosen as sons and daughters of God. Our final song this morning is I Will Make Known. As we sing this, let the words sink into your soul. Meditate on it as you go about your week and keep asking yourself, how have I experienced God's steadfast love and faithfulness? And how will I use this to make him known to all generations so that we may become more like a family? Thanks, guys.